You unlock this door with the Wi-Fi password. Beyond it is another podcast. A podcast of sound. A podcast of sight, somehow. A podcast of mind. You're moving into a land of both shadow and substance, of trolls and fake news. You've just crossed over into The Last Knock.
Wow, man. That's pretty heavy, man.
That's what we go for on this show, Bill.
I love it. Too bad we can't play the music. But
oh, yeah.
Probably one of the greatest themes of all time.
Absolutely. And I am Johnny Rod Serling Numb tonight.
And I'm just Billy Crash, although I wish I my middle name was Richard Matheson some days.
Or Chuck Beaumont, or
I'll take Mr. Matheson.
Yeah, fair enough.
Yeah, but I mean Rod Serling, man, he's one of my idols.
Yeah, and if you didn't take a hint from the opening there, today is actually October 2nd, and it is sort of serendipitously the anniversary of when the first episode of The Twilight Zone premiered in 1959.
Mm-hmm.
And that is our topic du jour. We'll be talking about the original series, its influence on, I guess, the anthology show and anthology film. And just like some episodes that resonated with us, I'm sure are going to pop up. And yeah, so just a nice chill conversation about surprise twists and moral lessons. So.
Well, you know, it's funny that you say surprise twists because everybody's like, oh, what's the twist to this episode going to be and blah, blah, blah. And it's like, I thought like Rod Serling and company, you know, like you said, Beaumont, Matheson, and man, so many others, you know, William Claxton, Richard Baer, and
I mean, Earl Hamner wrote a couple episodes too.
Oh yeah. Yeah, absolutely. Buzz Kulik, Jack Smite, and, you know, whatnot. I don't really think it's like, you know, I think a twist is, maybe we just need to redefine it, because it almost sounds like sleight of hand. But yes, in this case, it was more like a logical reveal that was like, oh, and it seems like a twist because we're either not paying attention to the story or our perception is as off as the characters in the story. And, you know, and I think The Sixth Sense is the perfect embodiment of it. Like, everybody's like, oh, the twist. There's like, there's no twist. We just, you know, it was like sleight of hand by M. Night Shyamalan, you know? And a lot of these are really, really wonderful in regard to how they're presented. And then you get that, oh, I thought, yeah, that's the problem. And I think that's the beauty of, and one of the heart and soul elements of the entire Twilight Zone. And I think what Rod Serling was going for was to question your perception, or for us to question ours. And as an American audience, at least, you know, way back when. And I thought you did it beautifully time and time again. Time enough at last.
Yes, we have time enough at last to talk about it. You know what, Bill, you made a great point there about perception. Because sometimes you're the person who gets the lesson visited upon on the show, and sometimes you're one of the people trying to impart the lesson, I guess you could say. Mm. You know what I mean? But it, you know, saying it that way almost makes it sound like that the episodes would be didactic, and I don't think they were.
No, I don't think they were. I think that, you know, they were ahead of its time. The only thing that I saw, and I know this is going to sound like a weird connection, was to the great, you know, Richard Boone and Have Gun Will Travel. I mean, if you look at that, that's like almost a progressive Western, you know, and it took place in like the 50s and early 60s. And I remember one episode he was hired by a black gentleman, which was like, you know, unheard of and whatnot. You know, he was helping a woman doctor in the Old West who was shunned by everybody because, you know, she was a woman doctor, you know, like, and stuff like that. It went on and on and on. And then you had this, you know, the Twilight Zone came along, and you have this, it's almost like, you know, he's saying, we need to look at ourselves a little bit closer. We need to look at ourselves more. Where are we? What are we doing? And I love how so many of the episodes, not so many, but a lot of them had to do with, like, the Cold War element. And, you know, what are we really afraid of here? You know, like, you know, those were great. Space race gone awry. The whole atomic age gone awry. And xenophobia. And just some really cool fear elements in general that... because I think some episodes where people are like, oh, man, that was cool, that was awesome. It's like, yeah, it was awesome. But really think about that particular episode and what they were doing and how frightening it really is. Like one of my favorites is To Serve Man.
Yes, yeah.
And that's just a fantastic episode from... that was season 3. It was episode 89 overall. It premiered in March 2nd, 1962. And aliens land near the UN building in New York. And so close. Yes, so close. It's very quotable. It has one of my favorite lines of all time. And I use it, and people are like, what the fuck are you talking about? When what happens is an alien comes in and they accidentally, wink, wink, nudge, nudge, leave a book behind, and it's in their alien tongue, and the only thing that these code breakers can come up with is the title to the book, which is To Serve Man. And the lead in it, oh man, I forgot his name right now, I'm so sorry, he says, like, a colonel and a general or something. Yeah, a couple of colonels are like arguing, like, "Hey, man, you know, we need to be concerned about this." And he's like, "Well, the title's To Serve Man." And the quote is, "That makes the cheese a bit more binding, doesn't it?" And I'm like, "What the?" F-? I'm like, "I love it. That's like one of the greatest lines." And well, actually, the biggest line is delivered by his partner in the near the end. That book, it's well. I don't even know. Do we have to do spoiler alerts for this?
No, just do it, Bill. Yeah.
It's a cookbook!
Yeah.
And, you know, and the cool thing is they break the fourth wall at the end of this episode where the main character's looking at, you know, the camera and he's going, are you here with me on the ship? You know, it's like, we'll all be on the menu soon. And it's like, oh my God. And, you know, people are like, yeah, that's cool and all, but, like, can you imagine, like, and this was, like, I think the premise for the TV series V, know, the alien invasion, where it's like, yeah, aliens come, and they're like, giving us all this great stuff. They're healing us. They're stopping us from making war with each other. Everything's awesome. And then it's like, oh, man, but they're eating us. And it's like, so what do you do when suddenly it's like, wow, Earth is now a farm, and we're the animals on the farm. And I love it, man.
You know, something that's interesting about that episode, Bill, is like you were saying about, I know you were talking about the twist earlier and discerning the sleight of hand from something that's just organically part of...
Yes, organic, perfect word.
Part of the story, which the Twilight Zone did so well. But I like how we as viewers, like, we immediately go to that notion of subservience, kind of. It's like, oh, the aliens are here because they want to serve us in some way. They want, not in that sense, but they want to share their knowledge. They want to work with us or something like that, you know?
Oh, yeah.
Yeah. How to better work with humanity, kind of. So, yeah.
Yeah, like how obnoxious. And it was such a great play on words. Which I really, really enjoy.
And yes.
Who wrote that one? Hold on, man. That was, yeah, Richard Albert who wrote it. It's based on a story by Damon Knight. And, Richard Albert, he directed it. Rod Serling wrote the script based on a story by Damon Knight.
Nice.
And, it's such a good one.
Well, and you know something else, Bill, is that the Twilight Zone has a huge influence. And just briefly, there was an episode of The Simpsons, Treehouse of Horror, their ongoing Halloween anthology. This was one of the early ones where the Simpsons get abducted by aliens and they keep being fed all this, like, huge portions of food. And at one point, Lisa discovers a book, and it says how to cook humans. And the aliens come out, and they're like, oh, no, there's some dust on that book. They blow the dust off, and the title is How to Cook for Humans. And then Lisa's like, no, and she blows more dust off the book, and it says how to cook 40 humans, and then they blow more dust off, and it says how to cook for 40 humans. So it just kind of keeps going on like that.
Oh, I love it, man. Yeah, and Lloyd Bachner, he played Michael Chambers in it, and I love the ending, the closing narration from Mr. Serling, and I'm going to read it right now, yeah. Real quick. It's the recollections of one Michael Chambers with appropriate flashbacks and soliloquy, or more simply stated, the evolution of man, the cycle of going from dust to dessert, the metamorphosis from being the ruler of a planet to an ingredient in someone's soup. It's tonight's bill of fare from the Twilight Zone. And it's great because the whole thing's like, yeah, we think we're the shit, but probably not. You know, it's like, that's what I love. You know, it's like, there's your little moral. Don't think you're like, you know, the Cadmeans aren't going to get you. Just don't think you're, you know, you're all that smart and smarmy.
Well, you know what I think, Bill? I think for people who watch that and get that, you know, sort of like get the impact, I guess, not just the quote unquote twist. It's like, there's some heady stuff going on and stuff that, you know, people should, I hate to come off like this. It's not didactic. It's just kind of like these different ways of presenting universal themes that, you know, everybody stands to kind of benefit from, or at least open their mind to. So
no, I absolutely agree. I mean, I don't remember the episode name offhand, but I remember the one where the Black Cloud, like, I didn't think it was you know, necessarily a good episode, but where there's like going to be an execution and a black cloud comes over the city.
Mm-hmm.
And then all these cities are getting black clouds, the black cloud of hate, you know, and it was just like, but it was, you know, and, which was true. Maybe that was a little heavy, maybe, but.
Well, you know, Bill, to go backward a bit.
Yeah, let's go backward.
You know, I'm curious, what was your first exposure to the Twilight Zone, and what was your response to it when you first saw an episode or two?
Man, you know, it's funny because I can't even remember the first episode I had seen. It might have been the episode another one that I really like, episode 22, the one 22. I don't know if you're familiar with that one.
It sounds familiar.
Yeah, it's about a young woman. This is when they were filming in CinemaScope, so it looks a little grainy. And it's was directed by Jack Smite, written by Rod Serling once again. And it stars... oh my gosh, who played Liz Powell? Barbara Nichols played Liz Powell. And she's supposed to be getting on a plane... And she keeps having this nightmare where she's like, you know, waking up in like a morgue, you know, and it's like, you know, room for one more, honey. You know, one of the characters keeps saying, and she's freaked out. She doesn't want to get on a plane, blah, 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 blah. And then finally she's cleared from the hospital. She can go. She gets on this plane. Stewardess is waiting by the door, and she says, room for one more, honey. She freaks out. She runs for it. The plane takes off, and it crashes and bursts into flames. And it's like, ooh. You know, it's like...
Final destination, yeah.
For real. And that's the great thing about The Twilight Zone. If you look back at it and you see all the things that have come after it, it's like, how much did this influence, like, almost everything that we see? You know? In regards to thrillers, suspense, and... whatchamacallit, you know, horror.
And pathos, too, yeah.
Yeah.
And you know, that's interesting you bring that up, Bill, because there was Carnival of Souls, which came out in the midst of the Twilight Zone's run, and that's essentially a feature-length, like, Twilight Zone episode in its own right.
And it's so funny that you brought that up, because I was equating that to two particular episodes, and let me...
Oh, I, I know one, yeah.
Yeah, which one, man? Go for it.
Well, the one is the Hitchhiker, where it's actually a woman who is being menaced by, not menaced in this Carnival of Souls sense, but she's being followed by this man, like in a derby, who's just trying to thumb a ride, and he keeps approaching her car, but he's not talking, and she's just freaking out, basically.
Yeah, absolutely. That, and I think it's, I think that was Mirror Image. Let's see. What would you do if you looked in the mirror one day, discover a sociopathic copy of yourself going about your routine? I always thought that one combined with the one you mentioned, became Carnival of Souls.
Was Mirror Image the one about the woman in the deserted bus terminal?
Yes.
Yeah. Okay.
Which is creepy as hell, and because of that aloneness and weird stuff going on like the fringes that she really couldn't figure out. That, you know, had that Carnival of Souls feel to it as well. So,
and something Rod Serling really tackles well on this show. There's a lot of stuff about isolation and loneliness running throughout the series.
Oh my gosh, I can't remember his name because I don't remember the episode. The one where he's a prisoner on a deserted planet. And the only thing he has is this female robot to keep him company. And then it's like, okay, man, you're coming back. You've been given reprieve, you know. But we only have enough room for you. And it's like, do you leave the female robot companion behind? Or, you know, what do you do? Because he's in love with her. He's in love with his robot.
Oh, man, Bill, it's fucking Blade Runner 2049 all.
Yeah, exactly. See? Yeah. All roads lead back. To the Twilight Zone.
Exactly. It's funny how that works.
It really is, actually. It's scary.
Well, you know, Bill, like, did you, I guess, when you first saw
we didn't even
those episodes, did you find yourself, were you excited, like, mentally challenged and some stimulated by the show?
Oh, yeah. As a kid, it was just like, oh, man. And I think it, you know, really... You know, as a young writer, it just helped me, like, okay, you really need to think more before you, like, take pen to paper, you know? And I think that's why I think I liked it so much. I thought the stories were cool, and it's like I couldn't wait for the ending because I knew it was going to be, like, a kick to the groin, you know, most times. And that I really enjoyed.
Yeah, and you know what? When I first... I can tell you the first episodes I saw.
Oh, cool. What?
Because I was really young, and it's back when Blockbuster wasn't just in Alaska for the Last Stand. You know, it's when they had those two episode tapes, VHS tapes.
Oh my God, yeah.
So the first episodes I watched were The Invaders and Nothing in the Dark, which were like a. On one tape. And I know you like The Invaders, Bill.
One of my favorites, Agnes Moorehead.
Well, why don't you talk about that one? Because that's an interesting episode in that there's like hardly any dialogue.
The only dialogue is from a couple of little alien shits, you know, in it.
With Christmas tree lights, yeah.
With Christmas tree lights. And it's funny because when you go to type in The Invaders online, you normally it takes you right to the Twilight Zone episode.
Nice.
I want to see how it opens because I know it, I remember it opens like this is one of those out of the way places. You know? And Agnes Moorehead is a single woman, so she's not going to talk. There's nothing to talk about in a crappy, poor, diminished little farmhouse. In the middle of nowhere, she's making a meal. Suddenly, things get really loud and noisy, and something crashes on the roof of her farmhouse, and it's a flying saucer. And those are the invaders. And this is great, man. Talk about like this is like a perfect horror movie. If this was like you know this could be drawn out well. Mm-hmm. It's like a woman alone fighting off invaders, you know, from her little farmhouse, And I remember my dad saying, watch. And I'm like, you know, little kid, like, okay, I'm waiting. And then, you know, because, you know, we start to hear some talking near the end. And I'm like, what's going on? And then we see this insignia on the flying saucer. And we realize, oh, my God.
Race you blew
of
it up.
Giants.
You. Yeah.
No counterattack! No counterattack! Oh, man. And it's great because it's really cool because I think this inspired Trilogy of Terror with Karen Black in the 70s to like have some little, you know, Zulu voodoo doll type thing running around. Oh, boy, did I map. You know, Zulu and voodoo, two different things, but like, you know, some little Zuni, Jesus Christmas, you know, warrior thing, you know, running around, which is creepy because this is a creepy episode. You know, they got these little lasers and you hear bzz, 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 and she's got these little burn marks on her body and you're like, oh my God! She's stabbing them and kicking them. She's got her little carving knife and stuff. It's freaking awesome.
Oh, and there's a great moment in that episode where I think she's there's a hole in the door.
Yeah.
And she's like, I forget how it unfolds, but I think she thinks there's something on the other side of the door. Well, there is something on the other side of the door. She puts her hand up to it, and one of the invaders has one of her knives, yep. And it puts the knife through the door and slices the palm of her hand, and it's just like, oh, shit.
Yeah, she has it wrapped in, she wraps it up in a blanket, then it starts cutting through the blanket, then she smashes it and puts it in a box and throws it in the fire. It's like, oh my God! You know, like, you know, she's killing us! You know, it's like...
You don't understand! Well, you know, something else that's cool, Bill, is that, you know, Agnes Moorehead is the other just as much as the invaders are the other in that episode.
Absolutely. And that's why I think it relates so well to the movie The Thing, because you have, you know, us and The Thing, and it's like, but we're both the other because we're the other to the alien, you know what I mean? And as you just said perfectly, so I think that's awesome. And the Giants won for the day, and we don't know. We don't know, like, if the rest of her planet, like, is she like really poor and destitute, or are they coming up, or, you know, like, I don't know. But
yeah, it's like you have no sense of like, is she? Yeah. Well, Bill, you know, we're just gonna be going off on tangents, and that's cool.
Yeah, whatever.
I liked the episodes I watched when I was younger, but I don't think it quite clicked with me the way it clicked with you.
And why is that, Johnny?
You know what? I think my puny little youthful pea brain was, like, not far advanced enough to quite grasp what some of the stuff that Serling was getting at. Mm. Whereas, like, years later, like, I came back to the show when I was in my late 20s, early 30s, and started rewatching. I was like, oh my God, this stuff is fucking gold, basically.
And timeless.
Yeah, that especially, because it's like, the stuff you're seeing on these episodes from the 50s and 60s, these are themes that, unfortunately, a lot of them have not gone away. Like, you know, prejudice, racism, like you mentioned,
xenophobia,
you know, PTSD, wartime paranoia. Yeah. You know, a lot of episodes centered around like soldiers, whether they were, sure, you know, on the ground or on a ship or in a plane.
Collective fear. I mean, I think the episode that totally encapsulates the United States right now is the, you know, was The Monsters Are Due on Maple Street.
Oh man, Bill, talk about, oh, I love that episode.
Yeah, it's just freaking fantastic. Small town America, you know, anywhere USA, and little weird things start, you know, it's a regular neighborhood, you know, kids running around, you know, the whole nine yards, 1950s, women in their little skirts, you know, women stay home and cook, you know, the guys working on cars, and the guys, you know, we work for a living, we bring home the bacon, blah, blah, blah. And then things start to go awry. And I think it's really interesting because things just start to go wrong. Lights going on and off, cars won't start, you know, misinterpret, you know, fear just gets people because, like, what's going on? And it's one little kid, this one little nerdy shit, you know, he just, like, ruins it all by telling, you know, by saying, well, it's like a, oh, well, forget it. Here we go. Maple Street, USA, late summer. A tree-lined little world of front porch gliders, barbecues, the laughter of children, and the bell of an ice cream vendor. At the sound of the roar and the flash of light, it will be precisely 6:43 p.m. on Maple Street. This is Maple Street on a late Saturday afternoon. Maple Street in the last calm and reflective moment before the monsters came. And it's like he keeps drilling at Maple Street four times in his intro to let you know, like, this is us again.
It's suburbia. It's America. Small town America. Yeah.
Yeah. And this little kid, you know, is like, let's see what happens. Yeah. They gather in the street to discuss the situation because their power went off. And it's funny because like lawnmowers don't even work. The phone doesn't work. The cars don't work. Everything is just shot to shit. And then one little boy's like, oh, he's reading stories about an alien invasion. He's like, oh, it's the monsters and all that. And everybody's like, yeah, whatever. And then they start really buying into it because all this creepy, weird stuff keeps happening. And they can't figure things out. And then they're wondering who's who, what's what. It becomes this witch hunt.
It's the thing all over again.
It's the thing all over again. And the ending is just priceless because it's on a nearby hilltop. There's an alien spaceship, and they're fooling with a device that just manipulates all of their power and everything else that they're doing. And the one alien goes, "See, just flip a couple switches, and they'll end up ruining themselves." You know, we don't have to invade. You know, we don't have to unleash our armies. We don't have to use weapons. We just need to play with their, you know, with their toys, and they'll just ruin it for themselves because we're so petty and pathetic.
Well, it's like when Facebook or Twitter goes down and people are steaming when it comes back up. It's like, oh, blah, 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 blah. It's like, I hate this site, but I still use it sort of thing. Yeah.
Well, I'm just going to read it. The closing narration from Mr. Serling. The tools of conquest do not necessarily come with bombs and explosions and fallout. There are weapons that are simply thoughts, attitudes, prejudices, to be found only in the minds of men. For the record, prejudices can kill and suspicion can destroy, and a thoughtless, frightened search for a scapegoat has a fallout all of its own for the children and the children yet unborn. And the pity of it is that these things cannot be confined.
Wow.
Like, damn!
See, and you know the other thing, Bill, is more people need to watch this show, but then again, the level of writing, like, just considering Serling's opening and closing monologues, just listen to that. That is not a level of, that's not something people write. That's not how people write for television anymore. You know what I mean?
No, everybody writes with fear in their heart.
Exactly.
How can we keep this as innocuous as possible so we don't offend somebody somewhere for whatever reason? And unfortunately, that is where we're at. We have to, the pendulum has swung from one extreme to the other, and it's not in that happy medium where it belongs. You know, over the weekend, I saw the movie The Wife, which is a drama starring Glenn Close and Jonathan Pryce and Max Sonnet. Yeah. And it's an awful film, which is sad. It's poorly directed. And what it does is it's taking this element of this woman who's a wife, whose life has been subjected to, like, I'm going to ruin a movie here, but it's not a horror, so nobody cares.
Spoiler alert.
Where she's the reason that her husband is successful. And it does, you know, plays on the emotions and all that stuff. You're like, wow, look what she did. She sacrificed her life. But it's a shame because it's almost like, it's based on a book, and it's almost like they're exploiting people's sympathies by creating a story that has such a giant mega plot hole of that is so pathetic and weak that the whole thing crumbles down, and it undermines all of those other genuine stories of women being subjugated and subjected to manly, you know, men and a man's world, because it takes place 1992, but it starts back in 1958. But what the author did and what they do in the movie is just... Maybe it works in the book. I don't know. I haven't read the novel. But in the movie, they don't do enough backstory to make it work. And it's just... Like, it bothered me after I saw it. And then when I woke up in the morning, I had the answer in my head. And I'm like... And I remember... I think I woke up and I just said, fuck you, since I woke up. So I'm like, this doesn't work. You know, but this is a straightforward story of our own fears will kill us. We'll just ruin ourselves because we just, you know, we'll get stupid. And I remember seeing this horrible thing a few years ago. I saw the film. It was one of the footage. It was one of the most disturbing things I've ever seen in my life. I can't get it out of my mind. Absolutely horrible. This one, I think it was in Kenya. People got it in their heads that these five people in their town were witches.
Mm.
And they're forcing them into a ravine that they set on fire. And they're pushing them in there. They're whipping them to get them in there. And people are standing around like, what the hell's going on? Other people are like, you know, pushing them in. And you knew that if these other people who were just standing by the wayside going, what is this crap? And he said something, oh, are you a witch too? And he'd be in the ravine. Ugh. And I remember this one man sitting there. He's sitting in the fire. The fire is burning his arm. It's coming up around his back. And he's just sitting there, knowing that there's nothing he can do. And it was just fucking mind-blowing. And how this fear, you know, created that.
Yeah.
And we have it in our own country. And one of the problems that we've always had with... I've always noticed about our country is we always, regardless, Democrat, Republican, whatever, we always seem to need an internal enemy.
Yeah.
And an external one. And I don't know why that is. Is that so we can't focus on the real problems and we have these fears and we turn into, you know, we pick sides and people fight amongst themselves? Why the people in Washington, you know, drink scotch and laugh at us? I mean, I don't know. I'm not a conspiracy theorist, but it's like, why do we always have to do that? And
yeah.
And I think that's funny, and I know xenophobia comes in here, but I think it's interesting where you take this normal Maple Street town, all white people.
yeah.
And all these white people even turn on each other, and I just love what they said. You know, it's like, just everybody just stop. Don't let your emotions get ahead of you and just think logically about stuff before you make a move. And that's awesome.
Well, you know, Bill, our last show was on Night of the Living Dead, and that Romero does a great job, especially in that movie, I think, of doing kind of a Monsters or do a Maple Street kind of a breakdown of society and civilization represented in this microcosm of people in this farmhouse.
Oh, hell yeah.
But I mean, because it's sort of the same switcheroo. It's like, oh man, the zombies, the ghouls are the enemy. And then the more you hang out with these people, it's like, no, these people don't need any help. You know?
Exactly. Exactly. Yeah. You know, will the real enemy please stand up? Definitely. I completely agree. And, I just think it's funny how you know what Romero did, which is great because, you know, people, you know, you have people in those situations. You have people who want to fight, people who want to you know, like, let's do something. You know, people who don't want to. You know, people who are like, well, let's wait for people to help us. And you know, you have that like whole master mix there. Like, well, what do we do? What are the authorities saying? I don't know nothing. You know, like, you know, it's like, you know, so like what. You know, so what do you do? What do we do? And, you know, now in the United States, since 9/11 and stuff, they're like, well, have an emergency plan ready. And it's like, okay, you know, all right. So, and then what do? You know, you duct tape your doors. You know, what are you going to do? And so many people don't have a plan, and then they end up in crappy situations and they're screwed. But the thing is, like, the plan should include people just helping each other out, which we always see when there's a disaster, which is nice, but there's too many people who, I don't know,
well, just, you know what?
create problems and make them worse, you know?
You know what, Bill? That's a good segue into an episode I like, which pretty much echoes that that sentiment you're talking about. It's The Shelter.
Oh my God, that's one of my favorites.
Yeah, and again, it takes us back to suburbia. There's some sort of what's the incident that's causing everyone to panic? Is there some sort of bomb threat or air raid going on?
Well, that's it. That's it. Civil defense comes on. You know, and it's like, you know, take shelter if you have it, blah blah blah. And these people again in suburbia, these white people,
right
you know, professional people, they're all having a good time at a party and stuff like that, and it's like, oh my gosh, we've got to get to a shelter real quick. Well, guess what, only one neighbor has a bomb shelter,
right?
And it's like, well, it could only take so many. And it's like, well, you gotta let us in, we're your friends. And it's like and it just goes into desperation, hostility. And, you know, the father who's like, you know, that's our house, that's our bomb shelter. It's like, I got to protect my family. And it's like, I'm sorry, Tom, you're going to die kind of thing. You know, and he's like leaving people out.
Right, right.
And so the whole thing becomes like, you know, people are like the greatest friends in the world and are having a great time. This thing happens where you think, you know, the ICBMs are coming from the Soviet Union. It's like, well, screw you, man. You know, humanity's out the window and that's it. So it becomes a race to try and get to this bomb shelter, and he wants to get in with his family, and the other families want to get in. So it turns out to like there's a war, amongst them, and in the end, you know, the door is destroyed. You know, it's not going to work anyway. And then suddenly, false alarm! It was a meteor shower, something like that. And it's like, so now what do they do? Where do they go from here? It's like we. Because they said a lot of crap towards each other. You know, he wouldn't let his friends into shelter regardless and all this stuff. And it's like, well, now what do? You know, well, we had a perfect idyllic moment 25 minutes before, and now it's all destroyed.
You know, that's really good, Bill, because something those two monsters are doing on Maple Street in that episode really addresses is sort of the damage that mob mentality can do, basically.
Oh, absolutely. And they did that a lot because one of my favorite episodes is of all time is Will the Real Martian Please Stand Up?
Mm-hmm.
And I know it sounds a little corny at first, and it is a silly title, but it isn't a silly story. Cops in the middle of nowhere, someone reports like seeing a flying saucer crash in a lake. They go check it out in a lake, and it's like, you know, treetops are down, and then they notice, hey, there's a set of footprints leaving from the lake, from the pond, and it goes up to this diner. So they go in a diner, and there's a busload of people, and they're like, well, you know, this is a little weird, but, somebody walked out of the lake, we think, or something like that. And so you have this great cast of characters, and then suddenly they start to turn on each other because they realize that, hey, wait a minute, there was only 7 people on a bus, but there's 8 of us in here. And it's like, oh. And then something. Then the jukebox goes on, and then it winds down. Phone calls, phone rings. Then there's nobody there. People are freaking out. The sugar on the table explodes, and then the one couple's like, "Well, you know, you could figure out who the Martian is, you know, because like, well, we're a couple, you know, so that we're exonerated." And then this one young couple goes, I never noticed that mole on your face before. And then it's like, and then it's like, oh my gosh, what's going on? And it's a great episode with a great ending. And that Rush even used in a song of theirs off the 2112 album of theirs way back. And it's great, again, just to inject a little fear, a little suspicion, and people's fears take off on their own. And that's why, you know, be weary of, fake tweets and, false reports. Like Jeff Goldblum, you know, I remember when he was like, I didn't die. And people were like, you know, some idiot sent around this one tweet several years ago. Jeff Goldblum died in China. You know, he fell off a platform or something like that. I was like, what?
Oh, well, you know what, Bill? I think sometime last year someone started a rumor about John Carpenter being dead.
Yeah, they did.
And he had to come on social media and say, oh, I assure you, I am not dead.
Exactly. The rumor of my death is greatly exaggerated, like Mark Twain, you know. But we've done this forever, you know, human beings, you know. They've even noticed this in primates. This one, what was it? I think it was just a monkey. He was giving the warning of an attack, so everybody would go run and hide, and he could steal some food. It's just like, what the fuck? We are not far removed from our primate cousins, And so I thought this was really interesting because, people again are pitted against each other. They don't know who's who, what's what. And then they're like, screw it. Let's get out of here. The engineer said the bridge is fine. Fine, we'll go on the bridge, the bus. And of course, nobody makes it except for one person. But again, it was fear. It's just selling fear.
Yeah, and I think, yeah, and there's so much of that. I feel like it's kind of it's weird because it's sort of like that Bill Hicks bit
Oh,
from
yeah.
years ago where he was talking about he's talking about Ted Turner and CNN, and he's like, well, I turn on the news, and all I hear is war, famine, AIDS, poverty. I look out the window and I'm like, crickets. And he's like, Ted Turner is in his room making this shit up. If Jane Fonda doesn't, if I don't get laid, nobody gets laid. So it's like this manufacturer of outrage in a lot of ways. And sometimes I think it's a case of, this is the way that we now feel like we are a part of something, is by being all pissed off together, kind of.
I mean, look at what, yellow journalism had its start back in the Spanish-American War, 1898. William Hearst and company, spreading all of this crap about, Cubans and the Spanish in Cuba and what they were doing and how they blew up the Maine, which they didn't, and it led us to declare war, and we even stole Puerto Rico, like made it a colony. And all this other crap, and just because Roosevelt called it a splendid little war, and it was just like, just drumbeat shit from the newspaper, because you're supposed to trust the news that you read. And now we don't even have like investigative journalists anymore. If William R. Murrow were alive, he would be probably blowing his brains out on television. It's like, where's the real reporting? Like, do we really know what's going on anymore?
Yeah, it's kind of I know it kind of drives me mad, which is why I try to distance myself from it a lot of the time, because I just can't help but feel like, is this the way it's always been? Has it always been a matter of our bottom line is we got to make money, and well, if we're spreading shit, does it really matter? Because that's on the public.
Yeah, well, good news doesn't sell, right? I mean, you have to have crappy news. I remember when JonBenet Ramsey was killed, a little girl in Colorado, many, many moons ago. There were five other big kidnappings in the country at the time, but because of the newsworthy appeal of her being this little, princess, doing all of these shows, her mother being like a queen, and her parents being wealthy, that she's the one that got wire service. It's like, yeah, this is the one that's going to get us good ratings. And the other five kids, well, screw you kids, it's like, you're not going to get airtime because you're not going to get that 15 minutes of fame after your kidnapping slash death, because you just don't rate that high.
Well, and it's like, what you see on magazines is like, it's the beautiful people, even in their moments of tragedy. That's, it's, as Manson said, it's the all
I
relative to the size of your steeple,
yeah, absolutely. Eye of the Beholder. I mean, one of the excellent Twilight Zone re episodes.
Yes, that is a fantastic one. Again, it's a we're yeah, who wrote that one, Bill?
Great, you put me on the spot. Johnny on the spot. Put me on the spot, you son of
See,
a
that's the
bitch.
twist, Bill. I put Billy on the spot, so it's not Johnny on the spot.
Whoa. Which
What a
one was that?
twist.
Well, yeah, what a twist. I gotta get back to it. Back to my mega list, because I was looking at something else, because I didn't expect that curveball. Eye of the Beholder. When was that one done? Aha! Episode 42, season 2. That was Douglas Hayes. He directed it. Written by Rod Serling. And it appeared on Veterans Day, November 11th, 1960.
Huh.
Where a woman's in a hospital going for treatment. And we're going to remove the bandages now. Remember what happened last time. We want you to be calm. You know, it's like, this is your fifth surgery. This is the last time we can do it. And so the whole thing is great because you're seeing it from her perspective. Like, so taking the gauze off her face. You know, you see the light coming through. Oh, I could see the light now, just a little. All right, stay calm. You know, and they take the bandages off her head. Then the scalpel drops. People freak out. No change. No change at all. And you look, and she is freaking gorgeous. And it's like, what the hell's going on? And all the doctors and everyone else, they're pig people. They look like pigs.
Yeah, they've got these distorted features going on. Yeah.
Oh, my God. And it's like, what the hell's happening, you know? And, yeah, who's it? Janet Tyler? Who played? Yeah, Maxine Stewart, she played. Didn't she play the lead in that?
I don't know. I don't remember that being, I mean, I don't remember the, because she is eventually paired up with this enormously handsome fellow who, in the eyes of the show, is, you know, he's abnormal, you know.
Right.
He and the woman are abnormal because they look like us, and they're outnumbered by the pig people.
Yeah, and, you know, so they have to go because they have a fascist government in place, very Orwellian, very 1984. Let's get rid of these people. They don't belong. So they're going on this island where she'll be with people like her. And the closing narration is freaking amazing. I love Rod Serling. I love you. I really do. Now, the question that comes to mind, where is this place and when is it? What kind of world where ugliness is the norm and beauty the deviation from that norm? You want an answer? The answer is, it doesn't make any difference. Because the old saying happens to be true. Beauty is in the eye of the beholder. In this year or 100 years hence, on this planet or wherever there is human life, perhaps out amongst the stars, beauty is in the eye of the beholder. Lesson to be learned from the Twilight Zone. And I didn't even say it. It's like, here you go, motherfuckers. You know, it's like, you sons of bitches. Who are you to say? Like, and pretty much like the through line that I got through Twilight Zone that is my through line is leave everybody the fuck alone. Just leave everybody alone. Unless they're hurting somebody, just leave them alone to whatever they're doing.
Yeah, and you know, something else, Bill, is like, there's this sort of notion of, you know, get off your frickin' high horse kind of thing, you know, and stop judging, you know.
Oh, yeah. Well, that, don't, oh, absolutely.
The simple lesson of don't judge a book by its cover, don't judge someone by their appearance, you know. It's,
yep.
You know, it's, again, it's still applicable to this day, but again, Serling and company don't condescend to the viewer. That's what's so, it's not a fucking after school special. It has that,
right, exactly.
It has that element of the imaginative, I don't know what you would call it.
Well, here's why I got confused with the actress.
Okay.
Because and I never realized it until now, Maxine Stewart played the character Janet Tyler under bandages. When she was unmasked, Donna Douglas took over.
Really?
Yeah, I didn't know that until right now.
Very interesting. Yeah.
Intriguing, to say the least. But
you know, Bill, there were a lot of really well-known actors got their...
Robert Redford
in the episode.
Played Death, yeah.
Yeah, in the episode I mentioned, man, it's interesting to look at him in that episode and look at him now in The Old Man and the Gun, that movie he's doing.
Yeah, yeah. He's still but, with us, man. Oh.
Well, and you know, you had like Dean Stockwell, you had George Takei, you had, you know, one episode I really liked, two, and we keep saying two and mentioning two is the is that episode
Bronson,
with
Charles Bronson, yeah,
and Elizabeth Montgomery.
One of my favorites.
I love that episode. I mean, the synopsis is two survivors of an apocalyptic battle, a man and a woman, from each opposing sides approach each other suspiciously.
Yeah, your new Adam and Eve, you know. And as soon as I remember when I was in my 20s and I saw it, I'm like, dude, Elizabeth Montgomery, the way she looks in that, she's goth. She's like, she set the whole goth standard. You know?
She's Susie before Susie, yeah.
Oh, that was such a fantastic episode. It's like, yeah, what do you do when the war is over and the hate still percolates? But everybody's gone, you know?
Yeah, I think it's interesting because I don't know if Elizabeth Montgomery actually has any lines in that episode.
No, she's like mute. She's silent.
Yeah, because she doesn't trust Charles Bronson. Charles Bronson, meanwhile, is being expressive. He's saying, what's the point in continuing this fight? It's just the two of us.
Yeah,
Why this is an exercise in futility. And a lot of it is him trying to convince her of this throughout the episode. It's just kind of brilliant. And, you know, for as much as Bronson kind of got typecast later in his career as kind of the death wish, man of few words kind of character,
mm-hmm.
it's really interesting to look at him in that episode and see, like, how much, you know, how much of a range he had as an actor that kind of went untapped in some ways.
Oh, yeah, absolutely. And, I don't know, you know, because you were thinking of actors, I think of Shelley Fabergé, who was in a couple of Twilight Zone episodes, and the one where she's the daughter of a husband and wife and doesn't realize that she's not human. And but one of my favorite ones was where she was it's the leather jackets with the gang of kids. And everybody thinks you're just young punks, you know, teenagers from Mars, you know, little misfits there. and it's great because the family, no one's listening to her when she says they're not kids, they're not human, they're from somewhere else, and they're going to kill all of us. They're going to kill the town, the planet. It's part of it. And they're like, oh, please, honey. You know, they're not listening to her because she's young, and they're not listening to her because she's a young woman. So many of these shows are just, it's great because, I mean, what Rod Serling tapped into is like everyone's scared to death. We just came out of the McCarthy era.
Oh,
we're
yeah.
going through it again right now in our stupid country. And uh-huh. and then, you know, and so the show comes along and it gets on the air, which is fantastic, a feat on its own. I don't know how long a show would last, you know, right now in this environment that was like this and went for the jugular. And they did.
We'll see next year when Jordan Peele's version comes out.
And that's right. Jordan Peele's resurrecting Twilight Zone again for what, the third, fourth time?
This will be the fourth time, yeah.
And let's see what he does. And I hope it's balls to the wall. I hope it takes no prisoners like, you know, Serling and company did. They didn't. They didn't take any, you know?
Yeah, and you know what, Bill? I mean, Get Out was like, I know the two of us loved that movie along with most everybody else last year.
Except for Palka. And his only argument is, it isn't a horror movie. And that's a fine argument. A lot of people had that.
Yeah, but I mean, I just think as far as like in like current capturing the spirit and the vibe of the Twilight Zone, I was like, that totally nailed it, right down to that fucking ending where I thought it was gonna go a different way, and I was so glad it didn't. Yeah,
well, that's what we called it. I remember that's one of the first things I thought. This was like an extended Twilight Zone episode.
Oh, absolutely. Yeah.
And which is fantastic. And yeah, I hope he does something wonderful with this. And I think we're winding down, I gather.
Well, you know what, Bill? I wanted to ask you maybe a personal question, because something I like about Serling's approach to some of his...
Whoa!
Is that your phone? Bill, get to the shelter!
I can't! They won't let me in!
I'm taking my cat. You can't fit Bill.
Oh, man. Yeah, thunderstorm warning and tornado warning in Stroudsburg, Pennsylvania at this moment.
Okay, then. Well, I guess if that's to be believed, maybe we should wrap it up. But I wanted to ask you a quick question.
Yeah,
Bill.
Go ahead, please.
Has Serling's approach to like drama and character like influenced your writing at all? Because I feel like speaking for myself, some watching these episodes as an adult, I like look, it's like, oh, sometimes it's just two people or three people for a half hour.
Yeah.
And that's, and it stays interesting. It doesn't get boring. It's dialogue heavy, but it's good. It's rich and it's advancing things along. And I feel like maybe subconsciously I've sort of adopted that because I really like limited characters, limited setting, yep. And just kind of let the characters and the setting do their thing in a way. Yeah.
No, I agree with you. I never realized until you brought it up, you know, that I need to say whenever I'm writing something, I need to say, what would Rod Serling do? You know, because, you know, he did it so well. And if I could leave horror fans with an episode that they need to see that I've only seen once on television and I only heard of for the first time 6 years ago, thanks to Ross Klavan, who wrote the amazing book Schmuck, which everybody should get. It's an episode from season 3, episode 99. It's from May 11th, 1962, called Young Man's Fancy. And it has to deal with a man who just got married to his wife and he's in his childhood home. His mother just passed away, but he's still clinging to mama. And the ending is really hyper creepy when you think about it. I'm not going to say any more than that, but okay. People need to see, you can get it on YouTube. So
gotcha.
There you go.
Well, you know what, Bill? I'm going to go in the opposite direction.
Sure. Go ahead.
You know, I gotta say, and it's a cliche, and it's a total fan favorite, but when I watched it, it really just kind of knocked the wind out of me, was the episode Walking Distance, where Gig Young is like sort of a big city ad man agent or something like that.
Yep.
He gets like waylaid at a small town gas station, and he's like, oh, well, the town I grew up in is like just a few miles away.
Yep.
So he gets up because the car is going to take some fixing, and he walks essentially back in time to when he was a young man. And it's just like, it's this weird trip down memory lane, but I find it such an affecting episode. It's like, oh my God, it's like all that stuff about how you can't go home again.
Yeah.
You know, and it's really, at one point near the end, there's this confrontation, not a confrontation, but it's a conversation he has with his father, who's like, okay, I believe it's you somehow, that you're in this time, you've gotten to this timeline somehow, but he says flat out, you can't stay here. You yep. can't stay here. And I find that so kind of heartbreaking in a way, but yeah. So it's like that growing pains kind of, I don't know. I just love that episode, and you got a young Ron Howard running away from something near the beginning of it.
Mm-hmm. So, yeah, he's running to the cornfield. No, sorry.
Well, I was gonna say, Dave Kay will give a shit if we don't mention the Billy Mumy episode with the cornfield. So,
well, we just did. So
we'll send him to the cornfield.
Yeah. Oh man. Yeah. Oh. So that, yeah, Twilight Zone, man, it's affected horror, it's affected thrillers, suspense, cool storytelling, television, movies, just about everything you see, you could probably find a thread to a Twilight Zone episode. Whoa, the lightning is really heating up here, Johnny.
Okay, well, Bill, I guess you better get screaming before you ride the lightning out of here.
Here we go. People you could find on Twitter. Who are we going to lead off with tonight? First, of course, the Night Gallery. And they're the fan of the Twilight Zone. No need to wait for a marathon. Join me for daily quotes and facts from Twilight Zone, Night Gallery, and Rod Serling's other works. And also go to the website, thenightgallery.wordpress.com. The awesome, the amazing Avid Readers Cafe. It's the independent author network, promotion and support for indie authors. Heaven for avid readers since 2010. And you can go to independentauthornetwork.com. AIC Forever. Who's that? That's Scarlett Genesis, the lovely, absolutely lovely woman. And what is she about? she's into The Walking Dead, horror. Writer, she's a violinist and a phenomenal one. She says, flaws make eclectic creatures like me. Unfortunately, she doesn't have any flaws. She's just amazing. And she's also started Ja Love Entertainment, and that's her music event promo page. Please check her out. A Fiend on Film, we were just talking about him. It's the social media page for Dave K. He's into horror, Indian foreign films, art, graphic design, noir, architecture photos. Go to the magnificent world of DaveK.wordpress.com for more. The phenomenal Isaac R. Thorne, Thorne with an E, dark comic horror. You can find his work on Amazon. He's also on Scream Radio, which is from the lovely and vivacious Tracy. And that's Scream without an E. And he's the host of The Horrorcist and TN Horror News. And also go to his site, IsaacThorne.com. Urban Death underscore ZJU. Zombie Joe's Underground Theater, haunting your nightmares with Urban Death. Tour of Terror, haunted theater attraction for October 2018, going on right now in Los Angeles. Go to urbandeath.com. Also out of LA, the phenomenal Ivana Cadaver. She's the raven-haired temptress who haunts, teases, and tantalizes viewers each week on her nationally syndicated Macabre Theater, which is on U2 America. And go to macabretheater.com for more. We're hopping overseas to I Am Gore Blimey.
Yeah.
He's a podcaster, a chili head, Archer's addict, Eurovision fan, and lover of weird, campy horror movies. And he's out of Wales. And go to strangeanddeadly.com for more. Shudder. If you're a horror fan and not watching Shudder, horror on Shudder, you're missing out because Shudder shows a lot of things that other places shudder from. I added that, Johnny. How's that? The best in horror, thriller, and supernatural. You can even try it free for 7 days. Just go to Shudder.com and check them out. And finally, another wonderful soul from the UK, Atlantis Kane. Who's that? That's Paul. And he celebrates all things horror every day. He's in the horror movies, Blu-ray, Steelbooks, artwork, indie film, Halloween. And he's also a big fan of Twitter. And real quick, because I want Johnny to close out the show, you could follow me at Crash Palace on Twitter, and also go to the website CrashPalaceProductions.com for links to this show and articles, and also to Crash Palace on Redbubble for any The Last Knock and Crash Palace merchandise. Johnny!
You know what, Bill? I wanted to issue an apology to some of our listeners.
Oh, shit! What did we do?
in a closing twist, the reason I was kind of late tonight to record was I was frantically searching my Facebook to find the post I made when I surveyed our listeners to give us favorite Twilight Zone episodes, and this was like last summer.
Oh my God.
like summer of 2017. I was like, this post is like in June or July. I could not find it for the life of me, and I know we got some feedback from people. I know Israel Finn.
Oh, the great Israel Finn.
Yeah, and our friend Randy Broska gave us some feedback on there, and I feel like Thomas Flowers did as well. I might be making shit up, though. So thank you to everybody. I'm sorry I could not find that post. I feel like I don't know. Anyway.
Well, we just gave him, you know, post-show scream-outs, so that's something.
Yeah, I just might not have gotten everybody. So if I missed you, let me know, and I'll send you a lollipop.
And all three of the people you mentioned are excellent writers, man.
Yeah, I contributed 2 reviews to Machine Mean, which is Thomas's site. Their Fright Fest for October is on vampires, so...
Awesome.
I did a review of Thirst, the Park Chan-wook film, and Daughters of Darkness. So.
Oh, I'm shocked, Johnny.
it's like over 1,000 words on that damn thing, which is the most I've written on it. So
you could write a book on it, Johnny.
Oh, I really could. There was so much I could have kept in there. But anyway, you can find me on Twitter and Letterboxd at Johnny Num, and there are no H's in those Johnnies, which is the... which is the ultimate twist of all. I don't know. I should have prepared I didn't prepare an outro for this show. I really should have done that.
I thought you did. That's why I wanted you to go last.
Oh, well. It's
oh, well. That's our outro. Oh, well.
People are accustomed to this aspect of our show at this point. If you're new to the show, sorry, but the ending is usually like a bunch of trailing, rambling thoughts from me. So.
And on that note, Have fun in the Twilight Zone, Johnny.
Stay safe, Bill, in the shelter.
Yes, I will. Watch out for the cornfield, man.
Watch out for snakes.
Yeah, oh man, that thunder is rumbling. I'm out.
All right, see ya.
All right, bud. Bye.